Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we plunge into these fascinating subjects, pulling out the kind of knowledge that just makes you feel instantly more informed.
Yeah, getting right into it.
Exactly. So today, we're tackling a real literary heavyweight, one that's, well, frankly, baffled interpreters for centuries, millennia even.
You mean the Book of Job?
The Book of Job, yes. Huh? Thomas Carlyle, not exactly known for holding back. He called it one of the grandest things ever written with a human pen.
I praise indeed.
And honestly, when you start digging into its layers, you really begin to see why.
Mm-hmm.
Now, right at the heart of Job's incredible suffering, you've got these three figures. They arrive, supposedly, to offer sympathy and comfort.
Right, his friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar.
That's them. And picture this scene. It's from Job chapter 2, verses 11 to 13. They travel, they see Job from a distance, and they don't even recognize him.
Just devastated.
Isn't it? They cry out, they weep, tear their robes, sprinkle dust on their heads. And then, this is the kicker, they sit in silence with him on the ground for 7 days and seven nights.
Wow, 7 days.
Because, as the text says, his suffering was very great. So you have this abrupt appearance, this profound silence. And then what follows is, well, a lot of talking, almost endless speeches.
A flood of words after the silence.
Precisely. And our deep dive today, we're going to zoom in on Eliphaz. He's the chief interlocutor, the main speaker among them.
Generally seen as the eldest, the most respected.
Yes, he speaks first. His speeches are the longest. But here's the puzzle. Here's the enigma we want to explore.
Okay.
Eliphaz is, genuinely, one of those eloquent speakers in the entire Bible. His words sound incredibly profound, full of what seems like deep wisdom.
You can see why people would be persuaded by him.
Totally. And yet, and this is the big yet, the very end of the book, Yahweh, God himself, gives him this really harsh rebuke.
Right. My anger burns against you, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. Strong words.
Very strong.
Yeah.
So how do we square that? How do we reconcile this eloquent, seemingly wise figure with this final divine condemnation? What are we supposed to make of him?
Well, that's the core of it, isn't it? That interpretive bipolarity you alluded to. It's fascinating how perceptions have shifted.
How so?
Well, for centuries, especially, in the Middle Ages, Eliphaz got a pretty rough ride, often seen as just plain wrong, misguided, maybe even malicious in a way.
Like a villain, almost.
Sort of, yeah. But then, maybe mid-20th century or so, scholars started this, you called it an interpretive rehab. They began seeing more nuance, suggesting maybe the author intended some ambiguity there, designed the character to provoke both negative and positive reactions in us, the readers, makes you double check your own gut feelings about him.
That's interesting. It's not just black and white.
Not at all.
Yeah.
And then there's the Apostle Paul angle, which just adds another layer of complexity.
What?
That's in the New Testament, 1 Corinthians 3.19, Paul actually quotes Eliphaz directly from Job 5.13.
He quotes Eliphaz authoritatively.
Seems that way. He says, "For the wisdom of this world is foolishness in God's sight. As it is written, he catches the wise in their craftiness." That quote. That's Eliphaz.
Wow. Okay, so Paul uses Eliphaz's words as, scripture.
It certainly looks like an authoritative citation, which makes you think, his words must have carried some serious weight even early on, and that makes Yahweh's later rebuke even more startling.
Yeah, no kidding. So, okay, how do we even approach a figure like this without just falling into, easy answers or caricatures?
That's the challenge. And it's where scholars like Dr. Kyle Dunham come in. His work, particularly his dissertation, The Pious Sage and Job, tackles this head-on.
What's his approach?
He calls it a composite view approach. Basically, he argues against simplifying Eliphaz. Don't just label him good or bad.
Right.
Instead, Dunham connects Eliphaz to these really important strands of ancient Near Eastern theodicy.
Theodicy. That's the attempt to explain suffering in light of a good God, right?
Exactly. Trying to reconcile God's goodness and power with all the suffering we see. So Dunham says Eliphaz isn't just some, straw man the author set up to knock down. He actually embodies the best, most cherished ideas about God and suffering from his time and culture.
Okay, so that really sets up our mission for this deep dive then.
I think so.
We need to unpack who Eliphaz really was. And you mentioned his roots.
Hmm.
Tracing this Edomite provenance, his background, to really get a handle on his theology.
Mm-hmm. Understand where he's coming from.
We'll explore why his advice was seen as, the peak of ancient wisdom, the finest elements of ancient Near Eastern and ultimately of human wisdom, but also, crucially, why it was ultimately judged as flawed.
Yeah, where to fall short. And I think we might uncover some surprising things about Job himself, too, and the whole cultural world they lived in, which hopefully has real implications for how we wrestle with suffering and God's providence today.
It's not just about what they said, but why it mattered back then, and maybe why it still resonates with you listening right now.
So starting with those roots, the Edomite connection.
Right. To get Eliphaz, we have to get Edom. Our sources are pretty strong on this, suggesting Job and his friends were likely Edomite.
Job himself, from Uz.
Probably in Edom, yeah. A kingdom southeast of Palestine. And Eliphaz specifically, Job 2.1 tells us, was from Teman.
Teman, a place strongly linked with Edomite wisdom.
Exactly. It's not just geography. It's a huge cultural marker. It really grounds his whole perspective, doesn't it?
It really does. And the biblical evidence itself lines up quite powerfully, showing how deep these Edomite ties run.
What kind of evidence?
Well, several things. The name Uz, for instance, pops up in Edomite genealogies back in Genesis 36.
Okay.
Lamentations 4.21 actually links Uz directly to Edom. It uses poetic parallelism, placing them side by side. And most names in Job seem to have Edomite origins.
Including Eliphaz.
Especially Eliphaz. He's right there in the Edomite genealogy in Genesis 36, listed as the son of Esau.
Esau, the founder of Edom.
Correct. And Teman, his hometown. It's repeatedly identified in prophets like Ezekiel, Amos, Jeremiah, as a key region of Edom. And crucially, it was famous for its wisdom.
Right, the wisdom of Teman, it keeps coming up.
The evidence is quite compelling when you put it all together.
So Edom wasn't just some, you know, obscure place. The Bible itself, even when talking about Edom as Israel's enemy, acknowledges this legendary wisdom. I remember seeing that quote from Jeremiah 49.
Yes. Is wisdom no more in Teman? Has counsel perished from the prudent?
Yeah. It's like even Jeremiah saying, wait, what happened to the famous wisdom of Teman? It highlights this long-standing reputation they had.
And it wasn't just in the Bible. Later writings, like the Book of Baruch, also link Teman and Edom with searching out wisdom. It was a known thing.
And part of that was location, 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 right?
Absolutely. Edom was strategically placed right along the King's Highway.
That major ancient trade route.
The main artery connecting Egypt all the way up to Damascus. This meant Edom was constantly exposed to traffic. Not just goods in caravans, but ideas, religious concepts, philosophies from all over the ancient Near East.
Like a melting pot of thought.
Precisely. Imagine a constant flow, an exchange of cultural and intellectual currents passing right through. So Edomite wisdom wasn't likely to be some isolated primitive thing. It would have been quite sophisticated, interconnected with broader Mesopotamian wisdom traditions, probably the cutting edge for its day.
Which makes you wonder then, why don't we have, like, libraries full of Edomite scrolls? Where's all the physical evidence of this famous wisdom?
That is a puzzle. Scholars have theories, you know. Maybe some got absorbed into the Hebrew Bible itself, maybe lost to time, destruction. Maybe we just haven't identified it correctly.
But we can still piece together the main ideas.
We think so.
Yeah.
Despite the lack of, say, direct inscriptions, scholars, people like Robert Pfeiffer and more recently Kyle Dunham, who we mentioned, they've synthesized what we can figure out about Edomite wisdom from the clues we do have. And the consensus points towards three main pillars, three core tenets of their theological outlook. And these are tenets that Eliphaz clearly reflects in his speeches to Job.
Three core tenets. What's the first one?
The first is this perception of God as fundamentally a fearsome God.
Fearsome. Not just awesome, but actually scary.
Exactly. There's evidence their chief deity, often identified as Kos, mentioned briefly in Ezra and Nehemiah, might be etymologically linked to a Hebrew word kots, meaning to feel a sickening dread.
Wow. Sickening dread.
Yeah. It implies a deity who induces real terror, often through supernatural experiences, not just, you know, reverence or awe. And Eliphaz himself describes exactly this, doesn't he?
He does. That vision he recounts in Job chapter 4. Verses 14 to 15, it's vivid.
Read it again, it's powerful.
Dread came upon me in trembling, which made all my bones shake. A spirit glided past my face, and the hair of my flesh stood up.
See, he uses dread twice. Trembling, this intense physical psychosomatic reaction, hair standing on end. For Eliphaz, this is how God's presence is felt, especially in judgment against the wicked, as a visceral, overwhelming terror.
That is chilling. Dread, trembling, bones shaking, hair standing up. I mean, you can almost sympathize with his worldview if that's the kind of divine encounter you've had.
It would certainly shape your theology, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. So, okay, if God is that fearsome, does that mean he's also unreachable, distant? Is that the next piece?
You've hit it. That's precisely the second core tenet. God is perceived as distant, utterly transcendent, way above the created order, separated from humanity by this huge chasm.
Eliphaz really emphasizes that gap, doesn't he?
He does. In that same dream vision, the spirit asks those rhetorical questions. Can mortal man be in the right before God? Can a man be pure before his maker?
Right.
And then adds, even in his servants' angels, he puts no trust. In his angels, he charges with error. The implication is, if even celestial beings aren't perfect in God's eyes, how much less so humanity?
And he has some pretty harsh words for humanity later on, too.
Oh, yes. In Job 15, he calls man abominable and corrupt, a man who drinks injustice like water. It's this picture of fundamental human flawedness compared to divine perfection, separated by this immense distance.
So this distant God, is he also basically unknowable then? Incomprehensible if he's that far removed.
That's part of it, yes. Eliphaz describes God as doing great things and unsearchable, marvelous things without number. There is an element of mystery, inscrutability.
Okay.
And this unknowability, especially by Eliphaz's third speech, seems to lead him to conclude that our actions don't really matter much to such a remote God anyway.
How so?
In Job 22, he asks Job, can man be of benefit to God? What pleasure would it give the Almighty if you were righteous? What would he gain if your ways were blameless?
Huh. So God is so high up, he's basically indifferent to whether we're good or bad.
That seems to be the implication in Eliphaz's reasoning there, this profound remoteness. And that feeds directly into the third tenet, which really underpins all their advice to Job.
Right. The third pillar of this Edomite wisdom, what is it?
That God functions as a capriciously retributive God.
Capriciously retributive. Meaning?
Meaning Eliphaz and the friends seem to operate on the assumption that God rewards and punishes, yes, but it's based more on his divine will and immense power rather than on a clearly discernible, consistent moral character or law that humans can fully grasp.
So it's like God does what he wants because he can.
In a sense, yes. Eliphaz says in Job 4, the evildoer is destroyed by the breath of God and consumed by the blast of his anger. It's direct retribution. Sin leads to suffering.
Okay, cause and effect.
But the key is why. It seems to issue forth from God's sheer power and sovereign will, not necessarily from a violation of a relationship or a known moral standard in the way, say, the Israelite prophets might frame it. Therefore, the highest good for Eliphaz becomes submission to that raw power. You can't argue with it, you just have to appease it.
Ah, okay. So fearsome, distant, and retributive based on sheer will. That all connects, doesn't it? It leads right to their advice for Job.
Exactly. They're coming from this theological place. So when they see Job's unbelievable suffering, their logic dictates this must be punishment. The suffering must be proportional to some great, perhaps hidden sin.
So Job needs to fess up.
Right. He needs to acknowledge his sins, whatever they might be, repent, and hopefully appease this fearsome, distant, retributive God to get back in his good graces.
And this is what Dr. Dunham called theological legalism.
Precisely. It's an attempt to achieve righteousness or restore divine favor through human actions. Humanly prescribed means confession, repentance, maybe rituals based on their understanding of how God works. It's a clear logic from their perspective, just ultimately mistaken in Job's case.
It's a crucial point, isn't it? Because you mentioned some scholars, like Manfred Oeming, initially saw the friends more positively.
Yes. Oeming argued they were initially genuine friends and good ministers. I mean, that seven-day silence showed real solidarity and patience. They waited for Job to speak first.
That's true. They didn't just jump in.
But while their initial actions might have been commendable, the counsel that followed, especially as voiced by Eliphaz, is where they went wrong.
So Dr. Dunham's conclusion stands. Eliphaz as a theological legalist.
That's Dunham's assessment, yes. Advocating for appeasement through humanly rather than divinely prescribed means. And this wasn't some fringe idea. It was common in ancient Near Eastern wisdom. It likely represented the very highest achievement and most profound perspectives of human wisdom available at the time.
The best humanity had to offer, basically.
But still, ultimately, merely human. It wasn't enough. It couldn't account for Job's situation.
Which I suppose brings us to the whole point of the book of Job itself, right? Its purpose in the bigger picture.
Exactly. It serves as this remarkable counterpoint within the Bible's own wisdom literature. It seems deliberately designed to subvert these traditional retributive approaches.
To show their limits.
Precisely. To highlight the failure of traditional ancient Near Eastern theological perspectives, even the best ones, to solve the deepest questions of suffering. The book kind of reveals the dark side of wisdom, those situations where the general rules, the neat formulas, just don't apply, especially in a complex fallen world.
Where suffering doesn't fit the equation.
Right. And ultimately, the book points towards a different view of God. One who is sovereign, free, and gracious. A God who can't be boxed into a simplistic cause and effect mechanism.
Which offers?
Well, it offers solace for the despairing believer. Not easy answers, maybe, but a portrayal of a God who is still directing and sustaining creation with divine, benevolent providence, even when the why behind suffering remains hidden from us.
So let's just quickly recap that journey then. We traced Eliphaz's wisdom back to its likely Edomite roots.
Mm-hmm.
We saw the three core ideas. A fearsome God inducing terror.
That sickening dread.
A distant God way up high, maybe even indifferent.
Separated by that vast chasm.
And a capriciously retributive God whose judgments come from sheer will and power.
Yeah.
And we saw how this framework led Eliphaz to share his own terrifying vision. Dread came upon me, the hair of my flesh stood up, and to insist, really, that Job's suffering had to be punishment for sin, demanding appeasement.
The logical conclusion from his premises.
Okay, so thinking about all this,
yeah,
what does it mean for you, listening now, if even the finest elements of human wisdom from that ancient respected tradition? Eliphaz's wisdom ultimately fell short. If it offered this theological legalism that just didn't work for Job.
It's a challenging thought.
It is. What might that tell us about our own maybe inherent tendency to look for simple cause and effect reasons for suffering today? How might Job's story seen through the lens of Eliphaz's flawed but understandable counsel push you towards, I don't know, a deeper, maybe more humble appreciation of both the limits of human wisdom and the, well, the sheer mystery of divine providence?
Perhaps the real wisdom isn't always in finding the answers.
Maybe it's in learning to live with the profound questions, acknowledging the boundaries of what we can truly know. Something to definitely mull over.